However you put it, Fred Colon was one of Vimes' oldest friends, and it was sobering to think that so was Nobby Nobbs. Vimes found the sergeant halfway down the Goblin Cave, looking strangely pink, bemused, but nevertheless quite cheerful, possibly because he was eating a roasted rabbit like there was no tomorrow, which clearly had been the case for the rabbit. Cherry was watching him with some care from a distance, and when she saw Vimes, gave him a smile and a thumbs-up sign, which was reassuring. Fred Colon tried to salute, but had to think about it for a moment. "Sorry about this, Mr. Vimes. Had some kind of nasty turn. All a bit vague, really, and suddenly here I am among these people." Vimes held his breath, and Colon continued, "Very nice, very helpful, very generous, too. They've been giving me all kinds of mushrooms, extremely tasty. Not very well versed in the trouser department, but I speak as I feigned. Makes a man think. I ain't sure what, but it does." He looked around with a strange fluorescence in his eyes. "Nice in here, isn't it? Nice and calm away from the maddening crowd. Wouldn't mind staying here for a bit. Nice." Sergeant Colon stopped, flung the rabbit bones over his shoulder, and reached down quickly into the mess of stones beside him. He picked one up. Was it Vimes's imagination, or did it twinkle for a moment as it once again turned into just a stone? "Stay as long as you like, Fred," said Vimes. "I've got to go, but Nobby'll be around, and just about everybody else on the watch, or so it seems. Stay as long as you like." He glanced at cheery Little Bottom. "But perhaps not too long." More thoughts passed as young Sam's daily stroll progressed back down the hill and through the village, and when Jiminy appeared at the doorway of the pub and gave Vimes a little nod that spoke volumes, Vimes's passing thought was that an astute publican knows which way the wind is blowing and adjusts his sails accordingly. No one knew better than he that no one knows where the rumours come from and how they are spread, but the little convoy, even though it included Nobby Nobbs and the Goblin Girl, got smiles and nods where a week ago there would have been blank stares. Because the dreadful truth is that nobody wants to support the losing side. When they reached Bramkin Hall again, Vimes found Sybil in the rose garden, apparently deadheading, something that had to be done because it was on the list of things you had to do in the country, whether you liked to do it or not. She glanced up at her husband and then got on with what she was doing, and said quietly, "You've been worrying people, haven't you, Sam? Lady Rust popped in unexpectedly for a social visit, right after you left." Snip, snip, went the secateurs furiously. "Did you let her in?" Snip, snip. "Of course, of course." There was another snip, snip. "And I gave her tea and chocolate macaroons, too. She may be an ignorant, whey-faced bitch who gives herself a title that is not rightfully hers, but there is such a thing as manners when all is said and done." Snip, snip, snap. "I only did that because that one rather spoils the symmetry, honestly. Anyway, I had a lecture about maintaining standards and banding together in defence of our culture. You know the sort of thing, it's always just a code." Lady Sybil leaned back with her secateurs poised and regarded the rose bushes like a bloody-handed revolutionary looking for his next aristocrat. "Do you know what the bitch said?" she said. "My dear, who cares what happens to a few trolls? Let them take drugs if they want to, that's what I say." Eyes ablaze, Sybil continued, "And so I thought about Sergeant Detritus, and how often he saved your life. And then there was young Brick, that troll lad he adopted. And it made me so angry that I nearly said something unrepeatable. They think that I'm like them. I hate that. They just don't get it. They've got on well for years without ever having to think differently, and now they don't know how." Snip, snip, crack. "You've just killed a rosebush, dear," said Vimes, impressed. "It took a pretty good grip to push those blades through an inch of what looked like small tree. It was a briar, Sam. Wouldn't ever do any good." "You could have given it a chance, perhaps." "Sam Vimes, you treasure your ignorance of gardening, so don't start weaving a social hypothesis in front of an angry woman holding a blade. There is a difference between plants and people." "Do you think her husband sent her?" Vimes said, standing back a little. "He is in the frame, you know, and I expect by the end of the day to be able to link him to smuggling, trafficking in goblins, and certainly attempting to send Jethro Jefferson abroad to get him out of the way. I know what happens to the goblins taken to Hoandland, and it's not good for their health. Jefferson told me that Rust was behind the eviction of the local goblins 3 years ago. I'm hoping to get confirmation of this very shortly. All in all, I'll wipe the smile off his aristocratic face at least." The birds were singing, and roses were pumping perfume into the air, and Lady Sybil dropped the secateurs into her apron pocket. "It will shame old Lord Rust, you know." "Don't think I don't know that," said Vimes. "The old boy tried to warn me off when we first got here. which just about shows his talent as a tactician. But I'll say this for the old bastard. He is honourable, honest and straightforward. It's a shame that he is also pig-headed, stupid and incompetent. But you're right. It'll hurt him, although he must have killed so many soldiers by his own incompetence that shame should by now be second nature to him. An old friend, as it were. He sighed. Sybil, every time I have to arrest some twit who thought he could get away with swindling or extortion or blackmail, well, I know that there is probably going to be a family in difficulties, you understand? I think about it. It preys on my mind. The trouble is, the idiots commit the crimes. As it is, I'm trying to spare some of the hangers-on in this case, provided their gratitude results in testimony. I can stretch the law for the greater good, but that's the end of it. Sybil nodded sadly, and then sniffed and said, "Can you smell smoke?" Willikins, who had been standing patiently, said, "Corporal Nobbs and his, young lady wandered off into the shrubbery with young Sam, your ladyship. The sergeant to Tritus accompanied them with what I now believe to be called," Willikins savoured the word like a toffee, "surreptition." This last fact was testified to by the shrubbery itself, because no shrubbery, however large, could hide the fact that a troll had just walked through it. There was a small, neat fire burning in the shrubbery, watched passively by Detritus and young Sam, and nervously by Corporal Nobbs, who was watching his new young lady cooking something on a spit. "Oh, she's cooking snails," said Sybil, with every sign of approval. "What a provident young lady." "Snails?" said Vimes, shocked. "Quite traditional in these parts, as a matter of fact," said Sybil. "My father and his chums used to cook them up sometimes after a drinking session. Very wholesome and full of vitamins and minerals, also, I understand. Apparently, if you feed them on garlic, they taste of garlic." Vimes shrugged. "I suppose that has to be better than them tasting of snails." Sybil pulled Sam off to one side and said quietly, "I think the goblin girl is the one they call Shine of the Rainbow. Felicity says she's very smart." "Well, I don't think she'll get anywhere with Nobby," said Vimes. "He's carrying a torch for Verity Pushpram, you know, the fishmonger." Sybil whispered, "She got engaged last month, Sam, to a lad who's building up his own fishing fleet." They stared through the leaves and tiptoed away. "But she's a goblin," said Vimes, out of his depth. "And he is Nobby Nobbs, Sam, and she is quite attractive in a goblin sort of way, don't you think? And to be honest, I'm not sure that even Nobby's old mother knows what species her son is. Frankly, Sam, it's not our business." "But what if young Sam eats snails?" "Sam, given what he's already eaten in his short life, I wouldn't worry if I was you. I expect the girl knows what she's doing. They generally do, Sam, believe me. Besides, this is limestone country, and there's nothing poisonous for snails to eat." "Don't worry, Sam." "Yes, but how will..." "Don't worry, Sam. Yeah, but I mean, don't worry, Sam. There's a troll and a dwarf in Lobin Clout that have set up a home together, so I've heard. Good for them, I say. It's their business, and definitely not ours." "Yes, but Sam..." During the afternoon, Sam Vimes worried. He wrote dispatches and walked up to the new tower to send them. Goblins were sitting around the tower now, staring at it. He tapped one of them on the shoulder, handed it the messages, and watched it climb the tower as if it were horizontal. A couple of minutes later, it came down with a smudged confirmation of sending slip, which it handed to him along with a couple of other messages before sitting down to stare at the tower again. He thought, "You have lived your life in and around a cave, in a hill, and now here is this magical thing that sends words right on your doorstep. That's got to command respect." Then he opened the two messages that had arrived for him, carefully folded up the paper, and walked back down the hill, breathing carefully and taking care not to punch the air and whoop. When Vimes reached the cottage of the woman who, to young Sam, would forever be the Poo Lady, he stopped to hear the music. It came and went. There were false starts, and then the world revolved as liquid sound called out of the window. Only then did he dare knock at the door. Half an hour later, walking with the measured gait of the career copper, he proceeded to the lock-up. Jethro Jefferson was sitting on a stool outside. He was wearing a badge. Feeney was learning fast. The constabulary of the waterside owned precisely one badge made of pot metal, and so, pinned to the shirt of the blacksmith, was a carefully cut out cardboard circle with, inscribed in painstaking handwriting, the words, "Constable Jefferson works for me, be told, signed Chief Constable Upshot." There was a second empty stool by the blacksmith, reflecting the doubling of the staff. Vimes sat down with a grunt. "How do you like being a copper, Mr. Jefferson?" If you're looking for Feeney, Commander, he's on his lunch break. And since you ask, I can't say Coprin sits very well with me, but maybe it's the kind of thing that grows on you. Besides, the smithy is a bit quiet right now, and so's the crime. The blacksmith grinned. No one wants me chasing them. I hear things are happening, right? Thymes nodded. When you see Feeney, tell him that the Quirm Constabulary has picked up two men who apparently volunteered the information that they had shanghaied you, amongst other misdemeanours, and it seems they have a whole lot of other information that they are desperate to tell us in exchange of a certain amount of clemency. Jefferson growled. Give me 5 minutes for them and I'll show them what clemency is. You're a copper now, Jethro, so you don't have to think like that, said Vimes cheerfully. Besides, the balls are all lining up. Jefferson gave a hollow laugh, laden with malice. I'd line their balls up for them. And just you see how far apart. I was a kid when the first lot were taken, and that bloody Rust kid was there all right, yes indeed, urging everybody on and laughing at them poor goblins. When I ran out into the road to try and stop it, some of his chums gave me a right seeing to. That was just after my dad died. I was a bit innocent in those days. Thought that some people were better than me. Tipped me out to gentry and so on. And I took over the forge, and if that don't kill you, it makes you strong. And he winked. And Vimes thought, you'll do. You'll probably do. You've got the fire. Vimes patted his shirt pocket and heard the reassuring rustle of paper. He was rather proud of the note at the end of the clack's message, which was a personal one from the Commandant in Quirm. It read, when they heard that you were on the case, Sam, they were so chatty that we used up two pencils. And then Sam Vimes went to the pub, just as the men were coming in, and sat in the corner nursing a pint of the beetroot juice with a touch of chilli, to help down a snack consisting of one pickled egg and one pickled onion nestling in a packet of crisps. Vimes did not know very much about gastronomy, but he knew what he liked. And as he sat there, he saw people talking to one another and looking at him, and then one of them walked slowly over, holding his hat in front of him in both hands, as if in penitence. "Name of Hasty, sir. William Hasty, Thatcher by trade, sir." Vimes moved his legs to make room and said, "Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Hasty. What can I do for you?" Mr. Hasty looked around at his fellows and got that mixed assortment of waves and hoarse whispers that adds up to get on with it. Reluctantly, he turned back to Vimes, cleared his throat and said, "Well, sir, yes, of course, we knew about the goblins and no one liked it much. I mean, they're a bloody nuisance if you forget to lock your chicken coop and such like, but we didn't like what was done because it wasn't... I mean, it wasn't right not done like that. And some of us said we would suffer for it come the finish, because if they could do that to goblins, then what might they think they could do to real people? And some said, real or not, it wasn't right. We're just ordinary people, sir, tenants and similar, not big, not strong, not important. So who would listen to the likes of us? I mean, what could we have done?" Heads leaned a little forward, breaths were held, and Vimes chewed the very last vinegary piece of crisp. Then he said, directing his gaze to the ceiling, "You've all got weapons. Every man jack of you. Huge, dangerous, deadly weapons. You could have done something. You could have done anything. You could have done everything. But you didn't. And I'm not sure but that in your shoes I might not have done anything either. Yes?" Hasty had held up a hand. "I'm sure we're sorry, sir, but we don't have weapons." "Oh, dear me. Look around. One of the things that you could have done was think. It's been a long day, gentlemen. It's been a long week. Just remember, that's all. Remember for next time." In silence, Vimes walked across the chimney at the bar, noticing above the man a patch on the wall showing gleaming paint on the plaster. For a moment, Vimes's memory filled that space with a goblin's head. Another little triumph. "Jiminy, these gentlemen are drinking at my expense for the rest of the evening. See that they get home okay, even if wheelbarrows have to be deployed. I'll send Willikins down to settle with you in the morning." Only the sound of his boots broke the silence as he walked to the pub door and closed it gently behind him. 50 yards up the road he smiled when he heard the cheering start. The Roberta E. Biscuit was, unlike the wonderful Fanny, a boat that strutted its stuff. It looked like a hogswatch decoration, and on one deck a small band was trying to play as hard as a large band. Waiting on the quayside, though, was a man wearing a hat that the captain of any fleet would desire. "Welcome aboard, Your Grace, and of course, Your Ladyship, I'm Captain O'Farrell, master of the Roberta." Then he looked down at young Sam and said, "Want to take a turn at the wheel, young shaver? That shall be arranged, and I bet your daddy would like a turn too." The captain shook Vimes's hand industriously, saying, "Captain Sillitoe had nothing but good things to say about you, sir, nothing but good things indeed, and he hopes to see you again some day, but in the meantime, it's my duty, sir, to make you king." The thoughts of Sam Vimes collided in their rush to get through first. Something about the word king was getting in the way. Still smiling, the captain said, "That is to say, King of the River, sir. A little honour that we bestow on those heroes who have taken on old treachery and bested him. Allow me to present you with this gold-ish medal, sir. It's a small token, but show it to any captain on the river, and you'll be carried for free, sir, from the mountains to the sea, if you so desire." Whipped to a frenzy by the oration, the crowd burst into loud applause, and the band struck up the old classic, "Surprised, Aren't You?" And bouquets of flowers were hurled into the air, and then picked up again carefully, because waste not, want not. And the band played, and the wheels turned, and the water was whisked into a foam as the Vimes family went down the river for a wonderful holiday. Young Sam was allowed to stay up to see the dancing girls, although he didn't see the point. Vimes, however, did. And there was a conjurer, and all the other entertainment people subject themselves to in the name of fun, although he did laugh a bit when the conjurer picked his pocket in order to put in the ace of spades and found himself holding the knife that Sam had brought along just in case. When you aren't expecting it, that's when you should expect it. And the conjurer had not expected it, and looked goggle-eyed at Vimes until he said, "Oh my, you're him, aren't you? Commander Vimes himself!" And to Vimes's horror, he turned to the crowd with, "A big hand, please, ladies and gentlemen, for the hero of the wonderful Fanny!" In the end, Vimes had to take a bow, which meant, obviously, that young Sam took a bow next to him, causing much moistening of female eyes throughout the restaurant. And then the barman, who apparently didn't know the score, created on the spot the Sam Vimes, which Sam later pretended to be embarrassed about when it became part of the repertoire in every drinking establishment on the plains, apart from, of course, those where the clientele tended to open their bottles with their teeth, or perhaps somebody else's. In fact, he was so overcome by the honour that he actually drank one of the cocktails, and another afterwards as well, on the basis that Sybil couldn't really object in the circumstances. Then he sat signing beer mats and pieces of paper and chatting to people rather more loudly than he normally chatted until even the barman decided to call it a day and Sybil towed her tipsy husband to bed. And on the way to their suite, he distinctly overheard one lady say to another in passing, "Who's the new barman? Never seen him on this run before." The Roberta E. Biscuit ploughed on into the night, the water leaving a temporary white trail behind her ample stern. One ox had been led into the stable in the scuppers, leaving the other one to maintain some sensible headway while the pleasure crews paddled towards the morning. Everyone except the pilot and the lookout was sleeping, drunk, or otherwise prone. The barman was nowhere to be seen. Barmen come and go, after all. Whoever notices the barman? And in the corridor of staterooms, a figure waited in the shadows, listening. It listened for whispers, creaks, and snores building up. There was a snore, oh yes. The shadow drifted along the dark corridor, the occasional betraying creak lost amongst the symphony of sounds made by any wooden boat underway. There was a door. There was a lock. There was a gentle exploration, being the kind that portrays cunning and strength rather than actually having them. There was a lockpick, a delicate movement of hinges, and the same movement again as the door was gently pushed shut from the inside. There was a smile so unpleasant that it could almost be seen in the dark, especially by the dark-assisted eye, and so there was a scream, instantly cut short. "Let me tell you how this is going to be," said Sam Vimes, as urgent sounds suddenly filled the corridor. He leaned over the body spread-eagled on the floor. "You will be humanely handcuffed for the rest of this voyage, and you will be watched carefully by my valet, Willikins, who, apart from making a really good cocktail, is also not burdened by being a policeman." He squeezed a little harder and went on in a conversational tone. "Every now and again I have to sack a decent copper for police brutality, and I do sack them, you may be sure of that, for doing what the average member of the public might do if they were brave enough, and if they had seen the dying child or the remains of the old woman. They would do it to restore in their mind the balance of terror." Vimes squeezed again. "Often the law treats them gently, if it worries about them at all, but a copper now, he's a lawman. Certainly if he works for me. And that means his job stops at the arrest, Mr. Stratford. So what's stopping me from squeezing the life out of a murderer who has broken into the room he thought would hold my little boy with, oh dear me, such a lot of little knives? Why will I squeeze him only to unconsciousness while despising myself for every fragment of breath I begrudge him? I'll tell you, mister, that what stands between you and sudden death right now is the law you don't acknowledge. And now, I'm going to let you go, just in case you dial me, and I couldn't have that. However, I suggest you don't try and make a run for it, because Willikins is not bound by the same covenant as I am, and he is also quite merciless and very fond of young Sam, who's sleeping with his mother, I'm glad to say. Understand? You picked the single room, didn't you, where the little boy would be? It's lucky for you that I'm a bastard, Mr. Stratford, because if you'd broken into the stateroom, where my wife, although I never dare tell her so, is snoring, at least as loud as any man, you would have found that she has at her command a considerable amount of weaponry, and, knowing the temper of the Ramkins, she would have quite probably done things to you that would make Willikins say, "Whoa, that's going a bit too far." What they have, they keep, Mr. Stratford. Vimes momentarily changed his grip. "And you must think I'm a bloody fool. Some bloke they reckoned was a great thinker once said, 'Know yourself.' Well, I know myself, Mr. Stratford, I'm ashamed to say, right down to the depths. And because of that, I know you, like I know my own face in the shaving mirror. You're just a bully who found it easier and easier, and decided that everybody else wasn't really a real person, not like you. And when you know that, there's no crime too big, is there? No crime you won't do. You might reflect that, while you're going to hang, I'm quite certain that Lord Rust, your boss, will in all probability walk free. Did you really think he'd protect you?" The prostrate Stratford mumbled something. "Sorry, sir, didn't quite catch that." "King's evidence," Stratford blurted out. Vimes shook his head, even if Stratford couldn't see it. "Mr. Stratford, you're going to hang whatever you say. I'm not going to bargain with you. You must surely realise that you have nothing to bargain with. It's that simple." On the floor, Stratford growled, "Damn him, I'll tell you anyway. I ain't the smarmy bugger. What do you want me to say?" It was a good job that he couldn't see Vimes's face, and Vimes merely said, "However, I'm sure the Lord Veterinary will be very happy to hear anything you have to say, sir. He's of a mercurial nature, and I'm sure there is hanging or hanging." Slumped on the floor and wheezing, Stratford said, "Everyone had that bloody cocktail. I saw them. You had three, and everybody says you're a lush." There was laughter as the door came open, letting in a little light. "His Grace had what you might call the virgin, Sam Vimes," said Willikins. "No offence meant to the commander. Ginger and chilli, a dash of cucumber juice, and a lot of coconut milk." "And very tasty," said Vimes. "Take him away, Willikins, will you? And if he tries anything, you know what to do. You were born knowing what to do." For a moment, Willikins touched his forelock and then said, "Thank you, Commander. I appreciate the compliment." And Sam Vimes finished his holiday. Of course, it couldn't be entirely fun, not with the clacks, not with people sending messages like, "I don't want to bother you, but this will only take a moment of your time." A great many people didn't want to bother Sam Vimes, but with great effort of will, they somehow managed to overcome their distaste and do so nevertheless. One of them, and this message did not contain an apology of any sort, came from Havelock, Lord Veterinary, and read, "We will talk about this." That morning, Vimes hired a small boat with its captain, and spent a happy time with young Sam picking periwinkles off the rocks on one of the many small islands off the Quirm coast. And then they gathered driftwood, made a fire, and boiled them, and ate them with the help of a pin, racing to be the first to get one wiggly morsel out of its shell. And of course there was brown bread and butter, and finally plenty of salt and vinegar, so that the periwinkles tasted of salt and vinegar rather than of periwinkles, which would be a disaster. For those unfamiliar with them, periwinkles, like cockles and whelks, might be considered the snot of the sea. With the boys out of the way, Sybil changed the world in her own quiet way by sitting at the table in their apartment and writing, in the neat cursive script that she had been taught as a girl, a large number of clacks messages. One of them was to the director of the Royal Opera House, of which her ladyship was a major patron, another was to Lord Veterinary, and three more went to the secretary of the Low King of the Dwarfs, the secretary of Diamond King of Trolls, and the secretary of Lady Margalotta of Uberwald, ruler of all that country that was above ground. But it didn't stop there. No sooner had the maid come back from carrying the first batch to the local tower at the top of the hill than she was sent spinning up there again with all the rest. Lady Sybil was a ferocious writer of letters, and if there was any person of substance on the plains and beyond who didn't get a letter from Sybil that day, it was because their name had fallen out of her beautifully bound and obsessively updated little black book, which was in fact a delicate pink with tiny embroidered flowers in it and a small phial of perfume. Nevertheless, the only comparable weapon in the entire history of persuasion was probably the ballista. In the afternoon, Lady Sybil took tea with some of her girlfriends, all old girls from the Querm College for Young Ladies, and had a very satisfactory time talking about other people's children, while silently, driven by messages sleeting across the land with a precision and speed that no wizard would have contemplated, the world began to change its mind. Concurrently, Vimes took young Sam to the zoo, where he met the keepers, nearly all of whom had known somebody on the Wonderful Fanny, and who opened every door to them and nearly every cage. The curator himself came along to witness this cheerful six-year-old who was methodically weighing giraffe poo on a pair of ancient snuff scales, dissecting it with a couple of old kitchen knives, and making notes in a notebook with a picture of a goblin on the front. But for Sam Vimes, a highlight was the elephant's delivery that young Sam had been looking forward to. Just as the Vimes party approached, Jumbo obliged, and his son was, almost literally, in a hog heaven. Not even the philatelist, finding a rare reversed head blue triangle stamp in an unregarded second-hand stamp collection, could have been happier than young Sam toddling away with his steaming bucket. Young Sam had seen the elephant. And so had Sam Vimes. The curator had said that young Sam was incredibly gifted, and seemed to have a natural grasp of the disciplines of natural philosophy, a comment that caused Sam's father to nod wisely and hope for the best. They rounded off the day with a visit to the funfair, where Vimes gave the man a dollar for the ride on the upsy-daisy machine, and was given change for a quarter dollar. When he objected, the man swore at Vimes, lashed out, and was surprised to be caught in a grip of steel, marched through a cheering crowd, and handed over to the nearest Querm copper, who saluted and asked if Vimes could sign his helmet. That was a small thing, but, as Vimes always said, behind small things you often find big things. He also won a coconut, a definite result, and young Sam got a stick of rock with Querm all the way through, which stuck his teeth together, another memorable occasion. In the middle of the night, Vimes, who had been listening to the pounding of the surf for some time, said, "Are you awake, dear?" And then, because this is how these things are done, raised his voice a little when he got no answer, and repeated, "Are you awake, dear?" "Yes, Sam, I am now." Vimes stared at the ceiling. "I wonder if it's all going to work." "Of course it will. People are very enthusiastic about it, you know. They're intrigued. And I've pulled more strings than an elephant's corset. It will work. What about you?" There was a gecko on the ceiling. You didn't get them in Ankh-Morpork. It looked at Vimes with jewelled eyes. He said, "Well, it'll be more or less a standard procedure." He shifted uneasily, and the gecko retreated to the corners of the room. "I'm a bit worried, though. Some things I've done come within the law, and one or two others are rather ad hoc, as it were." "You are just opening a way for the law to flow in, Sam. The end justifies the means." "I'm afraid a lot of bad men have used that to justify bad things, dear." Under the covers, Sybil's hand reached out to touch his. "That's no reason why one good man shouldn't use it to justify a good thing. Don't worry, Sam." Woman's logic, Sam thought. Everything is going to be all right because it ought to be all right. The trouble is, reality is never as simple as that and doesn't allow for paperwork. Vimes dozed comfortably for a while and then heard Sybil say in a whisper, "He's not going to escape, is he, Sam? You said he's good with locks." "Well, they have damn good locks on the cells here in Querm. There's a guard watching him at all times, and he's going to be taken up to Ankh-Morpork on their hurry-up wagon under armed escort. I can't imagine the circumstances that would allow him to escape. After all, the Querm lads want to do this one by numbers. I bet they'll have shined up their armour till it looks like silver. They'll want to impress me, you see. Don't worry, I'm certain nothing will go wrong." They lay there, comfortable, and then Vimes said, "The curator of the zoo was very complimentary about young Sam." Sleepily, Sybil murmured, "Perhaps he'll be another Woolsthorpe, but maybe this time with the missing ingredient of common sense." "Well, I don't know what he's going to be," said Sam Vimes, "but I do know he'll be good at it." "Then he'll be Sam Vimes," said Sybil. "Let's get some sleep." Next day, the family went home, which is to say that Sybil and young Sam went home to Ankh-Morpork on a fast coach, after a small hiatus, which led to young Sam's growing collection being removed from inside the coach and strapped to the roof, while Sam Vimes took the black-eyed Susan back to the hall, because there was still a matter of business to be concluded. Since he was a king of the river, the pilot let him steer for part of the way, admittedly staring obsessively over his shoulder just in case. And Vimes had fun, an infrequent event. It is a strange thing to find yourself doing something you have apparently always wanted to do, when in fact, up until that moment, you had never known that you always wanted to do it, or even what it was. But Sam Vimes, for a moment upon the world, was a riverboat pilot and was as happy as a cat full of sixpences. That night he lay alone in the vastness of Ramkin Hall, except, of course, for the 100 or so servants, turning the events of the previous week over and over in his head, and especially his own actions during them. Time and again he cross-examined himself mercilessly. Had he cheated? Not exactly. Had he misled? Not exactly. Had he acted as a policeman should? Well, now that was the question, wasn't it? In the morning, two young maids brought him his breakfast, and Vimes was amused to see that they were accompanied by a footman as a chaperone. In a way, he found that rather flattering. Then he went for a walk through the lovely countryside, listening to the liquid notes of the robin, etc. He couldn't remember the names of the others, but they were jolly good singers all the same. And as he walked, he was aware of eyes upon him from every cottage and field. One or two people came up to him, shook him frantically by the hand, and ran away just as quickly. And it seemed to Vimes that the world was dragging around after him. Nervousness was so saturating the atmosphere that he felt at any time soon he should shout boo at the top of his voice. But Vimes was merely waiting, waiting for the evening. The coaches started to arrive at Ankh-Morpork's opera house very early. This was going to be an important occasion. It was said that not only would the patrician be there, but he would be accompanied by Lady Margalotta, ruler of all Überwald, plus the dwarf ambassador and the black ruby viceroy of Diamond King of Trolls, who arrived in the city with almost as many courtiers, secretaries, bodyguards, chefs and advisers as had been brought by the ambassador from the dwarfs. In an unsophisticated way, the people of Ankh-Morpork were very sophisticated, and the streets buzzed more busily than usual. Something like this was important. Great matters of state would be settled over the canapes. The fate of millions and such like would be most likely decided by a quiet word in a corner somewhere, and thereafter the world would be a slightly different place, you see if it isn't. Unless you had a gold-edged invitation to the opera house that evening, this was no occasion to be fashionably late, in case you were left fashionably standing fashionable at the back, craning unfashionably to see over the heads of other people. Towards sunset, Vimes lounged against the lock-up, happy to acknowledge the fraternal salute of the pilot of a small boat that sailed past. Then he strolled along the lane until he reached the pub and took a seat on the bench outside. He took out his snuff-box, looked at it for a moment, and decided that on an occasion like this, Sybil would probably allow him a cigar. Through the smoke of the first luxurious pull, he stared at the village green, and most especially at that pillar of what seemed to be broken wickerwork. Somehow, soundlessly, it was speaking to him, calling to him, just as it had when he had first seen it. After a few more thoughtful puffs, he wandered towards the pub door. Jiminy beamed at him from under the freshly painted sign of the Commander's Arms, where he was enjoying the pint that the parsimonious publican drinks every day when cleaning the pipes. It's old beer, obviously, but what's beer but liquid bread, eh? And bread can't do you no harm. You look a bit preoccupied, Commander, said the publican. A mite pensive, as it were? Vimes nodded towards the tottering spire. How important is that, my friend? The barman glanced at the stack as if he couldn't care less. Well, you know, it's just a load of old wicker hurdles, that's all. They just stack 'em up there after the annual sheep fair so they don't get in the way. Bit of a landmark, you might say, but not that much. Oh, said Vimes. He stared at the tower. Nothing really, then, but nevertheless it spoke to him. Vimes stared at the heap for a while and then followed Jiminy to the bar. How much brandy do you have in here? Not much call for it, but I'd say 5 or 6 bottles and a small barrel. Jiminy stared intently at Vimes. Vimes knew Jiminy for what he was, nothing else but a man who knew enough to always be on the winning side. Vimes puffed his cigar again. Put 2 of them aside for me, will you? And you better make sure you've got good beer on tap, because pretty soon you're going to have a lot of customers. He left the barman bustling as he went back outside, and he continued to stare, his mind elsewhere, and in many places. Of course it'll work, he told himself. They've all got watches, and I know they'll have synchronized them, even if they don't know how to spell synchronize. It's a shout, like any other, and I've trained most of them, and I reckon that they know that if somebody says to them, do you know who I am, they know enough to say, yes, you're nicked. And he smiled inwardly when he thought that among the officers drafted in from the city were 2 trolls, 2 vampires, a werewolf and a dwarf. That's what they probably call symbolic, he thought. He pulled out his own watch again, just as the early seekers of an evening pint began to appear. Right about now. There was a huge jamming of coaches around the opera house as would-be patrons, high or low, forsook their carriages and took to their feet, fighting their way through the throng that was seeking admission. Of course, it helped if you had a squad of trolls or dwarfs with you. Ankh-Morpork liked surprises, provided they didn't involve the revenue. The curtain was not due to go up for another hour, but that didn't matter, because the important thing was to be there, and even more importantly, to be seen to be there, especially by the people you wanted to see. Whatever it was going to be an occasion, and you would have been there, and people would have seen you there, and it was important, and therefore, so were you. It would be a night to remember, even if the mysterious performance was an act to forget. The really rich often put on these things out of vanity, but this one looked particularly mysterious and possibly a jolly good laugh if it fell on its face. Day was turning into night. The pub was filling up, as were the drinkers, who had been told by Jiminy that they were drinking courtesy of Commander Vimes again. And Jiminy watched him carefully from the doorway as the shadows lengthened, and Vimes stood there motionless, occasionally looking at his watch. At last the lad everybody knew as young Feeney turned up, with his arm still in its cast, but nevertheless the old boys agreed amongst themselves, looking rather more grown-up than they'd ever seen him before. He was accompanied by Jefferson the blacksmith, whom they regarded as a ticking bomb at the best of times, and he had a badge just like Feeney. People overflowed from the pub as the two of them went up to Vimes, and there was an unheard conversation. They'd wondered why the blacksmith was carrying a megaphone, but now they watched him hand it to Vimes, and Feeney and the blacksmith walked back towards the pub, and people parted like a wave to let them through. Vimes looked at his watch again. More people were hurrying towards the green. People with an instinct for the dramatic had run home to say that something was up, and you'd better come and look. And country people liked a spectacle, or even a serious death, just like city people. They too liked to say, "I was there," even if it came out as, "I was there, ooh-ah." Vimes put his watch in his pocket for the last time and raised the megaphone to his lips. "Ladies and gentlemen," the blacksmith had hammered out a pretty good loud hailer, and the voice echoed across the green. "I have heard it said, ladies and gentlemen, that in the end all sins are forgiven." Out of the corner of his mouth he said, so that only Feeney and the blacksmith could hear, "We shall see." And then he continued, "Bad things have been done, bad things have been ordered, bad orders have been obeyed, but they never will be again. Will they, ladies and gentlemen? Because there needs to be a law, but before there is a law, there has to be a crime." There was absolute silence in the gloom as he walked over the green to the tower and broke the two bottles of brandy on its woodwork, stepped back a little way and threw the glowing end of his cigar after them. In the opera house, the gossip faded and died as Lady Sybil stepped through the curtains and onto the stage. She was a woman of, as they say, ample proportions, although she felt that some of them were more than ample. However, she could afford the very best dressmakers, and did indeed have the manner and poise that were to the symbol of her class, or at least the class she had been born into, and so she stepped out front of curtain, and applause broke out and grew. When she judged that it had gone on long enough, she made a little gesture which magically silenced the auditorium. Lady Sybil had exactly the right voice for these occasions. Somehow she could make everybody think she was talking just to them. She said, "My Lord Patrician, Lady Margolotta, Your Grace the Viceroy, Ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen, I am so touched you have all decided to come along to my little twilight soiree, especially since I have been rather naughty and have been very sparing of information." Lady Sybil took a deep breath, which caused several elderly gentlemen near the front of the audience to very nearly burst into tears. It had been said by someone years before that to see Sybil Ramkin's upholstered bosom rise and fall was to understand the history of empires. "I have been privileged recently to find a musician beyond compare, and without more ado I will let you into this wonderful secret. Can we have the house lights down, Geoffrey? Good. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honoured to be able to present to you tonight Tears of the Mushroom, playing her own composition, The Twilight Serenade. I hope you'll like it, and in fact, I know that you will." Lady Sybil stepped back as the curtains dragged themselves aside and took a chair next to Tears of the Mushroom, who was seated obediently at a concert harp. Beneath the seemingly impregnable composure, Sybil's heart was bouncing like a flamenco dancer. A low light, that had been the thing. The girl shouldn't be able to see the thousands out there. Sybil had taken her in hand, fearful that sudden exposure to the massed gaze of Ankh Morpork, far from her home, would have some terrible effect. But in fact, it wasn't working like that. The girl had a curious tranquillity, as if she hadn't realised that she should be in awe. She smiled at Sybil in her strange way and waited, with fingers poised over the strings. There was no sound but the susurration of people asking one another what the intense little figure they were seeing really was. Lady Sybil smiled to herself. By the time they realised, it would be too late. She looked at her watch. The flames were so high over the Ramkin estate that the blaze could surely be seen all the way to Ankh Morpork, bet you a gallon of brandy and a brace of turbot. There was barely any wind, and it stood there like a beacon. Vimes announced to the gathered throng, "Ladies and gentlemen, the area known as the Shires is under the rule of law tonight, and by that I mean the proper law, the law that is written down for everybody to see, and even to be changed if enough people agree. Chief Constable Upshot and Constable Jefferson are currently acting with the backing of their colleagues in the Ankh Morpork City Watch, who would like to be assured that their colleagues receive the respect that is due. At this moment, a number of people from the Shires are being courteously brought here, although possibly to their dismay. Some of them will be the people who call themselves your magistrates, and they will be taken away and asked to explain to a lawyer by what rights they have assumed that position. If any one of you wants to argue with me, please come on and do so. The law is there for the people rather than the other way round. When it is the other way round, don't hesitate to grab your weapons, understand? The bar is still free, but before you stampede, there is one more thing." Vimes had to put the megaphone back to his mouth, because the mention of bar and free in one breath has an invigorating effect on people. "Right now, ladies and gentlemen, the goblins on Hangman's Hill, and indeed all other goblins in this area, are under my protection and the protection of the law. They are also subject to it, and I'll see to it that they have their own police force. It appears that they make natural clacks operators, so if they wish, they can derive a revenue from so doing. I'm paying to have that clacks tower made permanent. You will benefit from it, and so will they. They won't need to steal your chickens, because they'll buy them from you, and if they do pinch them, then that's a crime and will be treated as such. One law, ladies and gentlemen, one size fits all." There was a cheer at this, as loud as any cheer in the vicinity of the prospect of a free bar can be. Of course, some of it might have been cheer at the fact that there was now some justice in the world, but on the whole, it was quite likely that the bar won the day. You didn't have to be a cynic, you just had to understand people. Vimes walked slowly towards the brightly lit pub, although the chances of getting inside were small. On the other hand, the chances of being given a hug by Miss Felicity Beadle were exactly 100%, because that was what she was doing, while being watched sheepishly by the blacksmith. He let go of her hand as she said, "You are a great man, Commander. I hope they put up a statue to you." "Oh dear, I hope not. You only get a statue when you're dead." She laughed, but Vimes said, "Listen, Miss Beadle, right now I don't know if I'm facing a statue or the sack. Some of the ways I've acted have been quite lawful, but others have been somewhat debatable. I have an officer who can do with numbers what Sergeant Adritus can do with a hammer, and he's going through the records of the son of one of the most influential people in Ankh Morpork. And at the same time, experienced police officers have visited the home of every member on the list of local magistrates. They are presenting them with a document under my seal informing them that they are no longer members of the self-elected Board of Magistrates of the Shires, and reiterating that there may be formal charges to be made. My justification for this ought to work, but now it's probably going to be a case of who has the best lawyers. The future, Miss Beadle, is somewhat uncertain, but I have to tell you that young Sam, thanks to you, is probably going to be the world expert on Pooh. I must tell you that his mother and I are very pleased, and only hope he aspires to higher things." There was already the rattle of wagons and coaches in the distance, the sound of pigeons coming home to roost. "I think I'll soon have people to talk to, Miss Beadle, although I suspect they'd rather not talk to me." "Of course, Commander. Can I say that the goblins seem very attached to your Corporal Nobbs? They treat him as one of their own, in fact, and he seems to be very fond of Shine of the Rainbow, as she is of him. You may be interested to know that the goblin name for him is Breaking Wind." She did not appear to smile, and Vimes said, "Yes, very apt. I've always thought of Nobby as a draft extruder. In fact, at my wife's express suggestion, I have breveted him to the rank of sergeant for his stay here, and I hope that he'll assist the goblins to understand the benefits of the law, although, of course, the fusion might simply mean that people's chickens will be more expertly stolen from now on. Oh, you are a joker, Commander. Vimes's expression had not changed, and did not change now. Yes, aren't I? He turned to Jefferson. You know, things would have been a lot easier if you'd trusted me at the start. The blacksmith shrugged. Why should I have trusted you? You're a knob. Do you trust me now? The blacksmith's gaze remained steady for longer than Vimes could be happy with, but at last the man smiled and said, Yep, for now. There was only one reply that Vimes could conceivably deliver. He smiled back and said, A policeman's answer, if ever I heard one. As the couple strolled away, there was a polite cough behind Vimes. He turned around and recognised the worried face of the colonel. Do you have a minute, Commander? Oh, dear, thought Vimes. May I first say, Commander, that I firmly agree with what you're doing, and heavens know it needed doing. The colonel coughed again and said, You will not have any disagreement with me on this point. Vimes waited, and he continued, My wife is a rather foolish woman who does appear to worship things like titles, and, if I may say so, gives herself airs. Her father was a fisherman, an extremely good one, but you know what? I think she would rather die than have anyone know. There was another pause, and in the red light, Vimes could see the shine on the old man's face. What is going to happen to her, Commander? At the moment, two polite young ladies in Ankh-Morpork City Watch uniform are standing guard over her in our house. I don't know if this helps very much, but the first thing she did when the arresting officers arrived was make them tea. There is such a thing as good manners, you see. Is she going to prison? Vimes felt the urge to say, Would you like her to? But he choked it back because of the tears. It's Charles, isn't it? The colonel looked surprised. As a matter of fact, Commander, it's Chaz to my friends. Am I one of them? And Vimes went on. Other people will decide what has to be done here. I've merely made certain that nobody can inadvertently leave before I've had the chance to talk to them all. Do you understand? I'm not the judge, and nor would I be allowed to sit on a jury. Coppers aren't. And right now, I'm not even certain what the penalty is for being stupid, vain, and unthinking, although it does occur to me that if I was to put in prison every person guilty of these crimes, we'd have to build about 500 more. Speaking for myself, Vimes continued, I'd like to see that murderers, if such I might find, are seen and dealt with as murderers, and the frightened and unthinking obedient also treated as they deserve. And right now, sir, I'd just like not to be living in a world of bloody fools. Personally, I have no particular interest in seeing your wife in prison, although I have a suspicion that if she was put in the women's wing of the Tanti, her horizon would be usefully expanded, and I expect she'd be so bossy that she'd be running the place after a couple of weeks. I do love her, you know, said the colonel. We've been married for 55 years. I'm very sorry you've been troubled, and as I say, I envy you your job. I think perhaps you should envy her husband. You know, Colonel, I'll be happy just for the truth to come out. Preferably on page one of the Ankh-Morpork Times, if you understand me. Absolutely, Commander. Vimes looked down at the man, who now looked rather relieved, and added, For what it's worth, I suspect Lord Vetinari will make certain of his backing, and possibly there will be some token punishments. Too many skeletons, you see, too many cupboards. Too many things around the world that maybe happened too long ago. What in the world can you do if some copper is going to go around digging them up? That's called realpolitik, sir, and so I suspect that the world will go on, and you will not be very long without the company of your wife, which should, if I may judge, mean that you can have more or less anything for dinner that you want for the next week. The idea seemed to uplift the colonel's spirits. The old man smiled. Do you know, Commander, I'm sure that, if treated with respect, potted shrimps might turn out to be my bosom chums. The colonel held out his hand, and Vimes took it, shook it, and said, Bon appétit. Afterwards, there were several explanations about why the quern wagon containing a very important prisoner overturned in the middle of the night and rolled down a very steep hill, coming to bits as it did so. You could blame the dark, you could blame the fog, you could blame its speed, and above all, you could blame the express mail coach from Ankh-Morpork that ran straight into it on the corner. By the time the wounded were in any state to comprehend what had happened, they were minus one prisoner, who appeared to have picked the lock of his shackles, and plus one guard whose throat had been cut. It was dark, it was cold, it was foggy, and hunched together, the survivors waited until dawn. After all, how could you find a man in darkness? Stratford was good at speed. Speed was always useful, and he stayed on the road that was just visible in the murk. It didn't really matter where he went. After all, he knew no one had ever given a description of him that helped. It was a gift to be indescribable. After a while, however, he was surprised and delighted to hear a horse trotting along the road behind him. Some brave traveller, he thought, and smiled in the fog and waited. To his further surprise, the horse was reined to a halt a little way from him, and the rider slid off. Stratford could barely make out a shape in the shimmering, water-laden air. "My word, the famous Mistress Stratford," said a voice cheerfully, as the stranger strolled towards him. "And let me tell you right now, if you make any kind of move, you'll be so dead that the graveyards would have to run backwards." "I know you. Vimes sent you after me?" "Oh, dear me, no, sir," said Willikins. "The commander doesn't know I'm here at all, sir, and nor will he ever. That is a certainty. No, sir, I'm here, as it might be, out of a matter of professional pride. By the way, sir, if you're thinking of killing me and taking my horse, I'd be most grateful if you try that right now." Stratford hesitated. There was something about the voice that induced hesitation. It was calm, friendly, and worrying. Willikins strolled a little closer, and there was a chuckle in his voice. "My word, sir, I'm a bit of a fighter myself, and when I heard about you chopping up that girl and that, I thought, goodness me, I thought, and so the other day, when I had my day off in Loo, very important your day off in Loo if you're a working man, I took a trip up to Overhang and learned a few things about you, and my word, did I learn a few things. You really scare people, eh?" Stratford still hesitated. This didn't sound right. The man had a straightforward and cheerful voice, like a man who didn't know very well, having a companionable chat in the pub, and Stratford was used to people being very nervous when they spoke to him. "Now me," said Willikins, "I was raised by the street as a fighter, and I fight dirty. You can depend on that. And I'll fight anybody, but I never punched a girl. Oh, except Kinky Elsie, who was always game for that sort of thing, and had me by the I'm not going to mentions at the time, and my hands were tied in more ways than one, as it were, and so I had to give her a sharp nudge with my foot. Happy days. But you're just a killer. Worthless. A bully. I fight because I might get killed, and the other bloke might win, or maybe we'd both end up in the gutter too weak to throw another punch, when quite likely we'd prop each other up and go to the pub for a drink and a wash." He took another step closer. Stratford took a step back. "And you, Mr. Stratford, set out to kill Commander Vimes's little lad, or worse. And do you know what is even worser? I reckon that if you'd done so, the commander would have arrested you and dragged you to the nearest police station. But inside he'd be cutting himself up with razor blades from top to bottom, and he'd be doing that because the poor bugger is scared that he could be as bad as you." Willikins laughed. "Truth is, Mr. Stratford, from where I sit, he's a choir boy, he really is. But there has to be some justice in the world, you see. Not necessarily law justice, but justice, justice. And that's why I'm going to kill you. Although, because I'm a fair man, I'm going to give you a chance to kill me first. That means one or the other of us will die. So whatever happens, the world is going to be a better place, eh? Call it cleaning up. I know you have a weapon, because you'd have run if you didn't, and so I reckon you have a blade from one of those poor buggers from Quirm, and I warrant that in all the confusion you probably stabbed him with it." "I did, too," said Stratford, "and he was a copper, and you're just a butler." "Very true," said Willikins, "and much older than you, and heavier than you, and slower than you, but still a bit spry. What have you got to lose?" Only the horse, steaming patiently in the mist, saw what happened next, and being a horse was in no position to articulate its thoughts on the matter. Had it been able to do so, it would have given us its opinion that one human ran towards another human, carrying a huge metal stick, while the other human quite calmly put his hand into his breast pocket. This was followed by a terrible scream, a gurgling noise, and then silence. Willikins staggered to the side of the road and sat down on a stone, panting a little. Stratford certainly had been fast, no doubt about that. He wiped his forehead with his sleeve, pulled out a packet of cigarettes and lit one, staring at nothing but the fog. Then he stood up, looked down at the shadow on the ground and said, "But not fast enough." Then, like a good citizen, Willikins went back to see if he could help the unlucky gentleman of the law, who appeared to be in difficulties. You should always help the gentleman of the law. Where would we be without them? The chief sub-editor of the Ankh-Morpork Times really hated poetry. He was a plain man, and had devoted a large part of his career to keeping it out of his paper. But they were a cunning bunch, poets, and could sneak up on you when your back was turned. And tonight, with the paper already so late that the lads downstairs were into overtime, he stared at the report just delivered by hand from Natch Bull Harrington, the paper's music critic, a man of whom he was deeply suspicious. He turned to his deputy and waved the page angrily. "Whence came it, that ethereal music? See what I mean? What's wrong with where did that music come from? Bloody stupid introductory sentence in any case. And what does ethereal mean, anyway?" The deputy sub hesitated. "I think it means runny." "Could be wrong." The chief sub-editor stood in misery. "Definitely poetry." Somebody had played some music that was very good. Apparently it made everybody amazed. Why didn't that twit in his rather feminine purple silk shirts just write something like that? After all, it said everything you needed to know, didn't it? He took out his red pencil, and just as he was applying it to the wretched manuscript, there was a sound on the metal staircase, and Mr. De Word, the editor, staggered into the office, looking as if he had seen a ghost, or perhaps a ghost had seen him. He looked groggily at the two puzzled men and managed to say, "Did Harrington send in his stuff?" The chief sub held out the offending stuff in front of him. "Yes, Gov, a load of rubbish in my opinion." De Word grabbed it, read it with his lips moving, and thrust it back at the man. "Don't you dare change a single word. Front page, Bugsy, and I hope to hell that Otto got an iconograph." "Yes, sir, but sir, and don't bloody argue," screamed De Word. "And now, if you'll excuse me, I'll be in my office." He clattered on up the stairs while the sub-editor and his deputy stood gloomily reading Natch Bull Harrington's copy again. It began, "Whence came it, that ethereal music, from what hidden grot or secret cell, from what dark cave, from what window into paradise? We watched the tiny figure under the spotlight, and the music poured over us, sometimes soothing, sometimes blessing, sometimes accusing. Every one of us confronting ghosts, demons and old memories. The recital by Tears of the Mushroom, a young lady of the goblin persuasion, took but half an hour, or perhaps it took a lifetime. And then it was over, to a silence which spread and grew and expanded until at last it exploded. Every single patron standing and clapping their hands raw, tears running down our faces. We had been taken somewhere and brought back, and we were different people, longing for another journey into paradise, no matter what hell we had to atone for on the way. The chief sub and his deputy looked at each other with what Natch Bull would certainly have called a wild surmise. At last, the deputy sub-editor ventured, "I think he liked it." 3 days passed. They were busy days for Vimes. He had to get back into the swing again, although, to tell the truth, it was a case of getting out of one swing and into another one while they were both swinging. So much paperwork to read, so much paperwork to push away, so much paperwork to delegate, so much paperwork to pretend he hadn't received and that might have been eaten by the gargoyles. But today, in the oblong office, Lord Vetinari was close to ranting. Admittedly, you needed to know him very well to realise this. He drummed his fingers on the table. "Snark and Faugester. I'm sure she makes these things up." Drumknot carefully put a cup of coffee on his master's desk. "Alas, sir, there really is such a word. In Nothing Fjord it means a maker of small but necessary items, such as, for example, spills and very small clothes pegs for indoor use, and half-sized cocktail sticks for people who don't drink long drinks. The term could be considered of historical interest, because my research this morning turned up the fact that the last known Snark and Faugester died 27 years ago in a freak pencil sharpener accident. As a matter of fact, I gather that your crossword adversary herself does actually come from Nothing Fjord." "Ah, there you have it. All those long winters sitting around the stove. Such terrible patience. But she runs the pet shop in Pellicle Steps. Dog collars, cat biscuits, mealworms. Such deviousness, such subterfuge, such a vocabulary. Snark and Faugester. Well, sir, she is now the chief crossword compiler for the Times, and I suppose those things go with the territory." Lord Vetinari calmed down. "One down, one across. she has won, and I am cross. And as you know, I am very rarely cross, Drumknot. A calm, if cynical, detachment is generally my forte. I can change the fate of nations, but am thwarted at every turn by an apparently blameless lady who compiles crosswords. Drumknot nodded. Indeed, sir, but on that note, if you will permit me to extend that note a little, may I remind you that Commander Vimes is waiting in the other room? Indeed. Show him in, by all means. Vimes marched in, saluted very nearly smartly, and stood to attention. Ah, your grace, it is good to see you back at last. How went your holidays, apart from lawless actions, ad hoc activities, fights, chases on both land and sea, and indeed fresh water, unauthorized expenditure, and of course farting in the halls of the mighty? Vimes's gaze was steady and just above the patrician's eyeline. Point of detail, my lord, didn't fart, may have picked nose inadvertently. The exigencies of the service, I assume, said Lord Vetinari wryly. Vimes, you have caused a considerable amount of paperwork to cross my desk in the last few days. In some cases, the writers wanted your head on a plate. Others were more circumspect because the writers were in mortal dread of a prison cell. Can I make one thing perfectly clear, Your Grace? The law cannot operate retrospectively. If it did, none of us would be safe. Lord Rust, Jr. may have done, indeed has done, many bad things, but making slaves of goblins under current law cannot be one of them. However, as I suspect, the recent revelations about his additional activities have done his reputation a considerable amount of no good. You might not know this, Vimes, but in society this sort of thing can be worse than a prison sentence, possibly worse than a death. Young Gravid is a man with not many friends right now. I hope that will give you some pleasure. Vimes said nothing, but he thought the ball dropped. Vetinari glared at him and said, I have here an eloquent missive from Lord Rust Senior, pleading for the life of, if not the freedom of, his son, who he fully admits has trodden the family honour into the mud. Lord Vetinari held up a hand. His lordship is an old man, and so, Vimes, if your next remark was going to be something along the lines of even further, then I suggest you deploy a little charity. His lordship is anxious to avoid a scandal. Apart from that, may I have your views? Yes, the scandal has already taken place, sir, more than once, said Vimes coldly. He trafficked in living, breathing, and thinking people. Many of them died. Once again, Vimes, I have to tell you that laws cannot be made retrospectively. That may be so, said Vimes. But what about the troll kids who took that damn rubbish? Are you going to ask the Diamond King if they should be retrospective? I can assure you, Vimes, that the laws will be upheld. And since you ask, right now I am having to negotiate with the King, who is demanding of me, Vimes, that young Lord Rust be handed over for questioning regarding the manufacture and distribution of absolutely deadly troll narcotics. Of course, under troll law, the wretched man would be put to death, and I am saddened to say that at this moment in the complex world of human, troll, and dwarfen politics, I feel that might have some long-term repercussions, making it an unfortunate option for this city. I have to negotiate this problem, and believe me, it's going to take a lot of quid for the pro quo. And it's only 9:30 in the morning. Vimes's knuckles reddened. They are living creatures who can talk and think and have songs and names, and he treated them like some kind of disposable tools. Indeed, Vimes, but as I have indicated, goblins have always been considered a kind of vermin. However, Ankh-Morpork, the Kingdom of the Low King, and also that of Diamond King, Ubervalt, Lanka, and all the independent citizens of the plain are passing a law to the effect that goblins will, henceforth, be considered as sapient beings, equal to, if not the same as, trolls and dwarfs, and humans and werewolves, etc., etc., answerable to what we have agreed to call the common law, and also protected by it. That means killing one would be a capital crime. You have won, Commander. You have won. Because of a song, Commander. Oh, and of course other efforts, but it was your wife who got most of the ambassadors to her little amusement, which, I may say, Vimes, was eloquence personified. Though frankly, Vimes, I find myself shamed. One spends one's life scheming, negotiating, giving and taking, and greasing such wheels as squeak, and in general doing one's best to stop this battered old world from exploding into pieces. And now, because of a piece of music, Vimes, a piece of music, some very powerful states have agreed to work together to heal the problems of another autonomous state, and almost as collateral, turn some animals into people at a stroke. Can you imagine that, Vimes? In what world could that possibly happen? All because of a song at twilight, Vimes. All because of a song. It was a thing of strangely tinkling tones and unbelievable cadences which somehow found its way into our souls, reminding some of us that we have some. Lady Sibyl is worth a dozen diplomats. You are a lucky man, Commander. Vimes opened his mouth to speak, but Vetinari interrupted again. And also a bloody fool, a bloody headstrong fool. The law must start with a crime. I understand, but don't condone. Vetinari picked the letter off his desk. Lord Rust asks that his son be given a moderately short sentence, subsequent to which he be allowed to emigrate to 4X to start a new life. Since the man was deeply involved in smuggling, the fine will be harsh. He held up a hand. No, hear me out. After all, I am the tyrant in this vicinity. Vetinari slumped into his chair, wiped his brow, and said, And I have already lost my temper with an otherwise inoffensive sweet lady who compiles crossword puzzles for the Times. However, Vimes, Lord Rust refers to you as a man of honour and probity and astonishing integrity and vigilance. Moreover, he is disinheriting his son, which means upon his death his title will devolve to his daughter Regina, a ferocious woman, very difficult and hot-headed. And that, Vimes, creates another problem for me. His lordship is extremely frail, and, frankly, I was looking forward to dealing with the son, who is an ignorant, arrogant, pompous idiot. But his sister, she is smart. And then, almost to himself, Lord Vetinari added, But at least she doesn't compile crosswords. Now you may speak, Commander. There was a murder, said Vimes, sullenly. Vetinari sighed hugely. No, Vimes, there was a slaughter. Do you not understand? At that point, goblins were vermin, and no, do not shout at me. At this very moment, in palaces and chancelleries all over the world, goblins are becoming as human as you or I, but that was then. I would like you to be fully aware that the reason that Stratford would have gone to the tender mercies of Mr. Trooper is that he and his ruffians boarded the enormous Fanny. Yes, what is it? Vetinari looked around as Drumknot tapped him on the shoulder. There was a muffled whispering before Vetinari cleared his throat and said, Of course, I meant the wonderful Fanny. And he did not exactly meet Vimes's gaze as he continued, That was an act of piracy, and the good people of Quirm, where the boat in question was registered, are all in favour of the death penalty for that kind of thing. I am aware of his manifold other crimes, but, alas, you can only hang a man once. Although, as it turned out, apparently Mr. Stratford was mortally wounded in a collision 3 nights ago, being thrown some distance from the wreckage with a surgically cut throat. Convenient, don't you think? Don't you dare look at me like that, sir! Heavens, I wouldn't accuse you, Commander. I was just wondering if you knew of any other person with a grudge against the corpse. No, sir, said Vimes, pulling himself to attention. You know, Vimes, sometimes your expression becomes so wooden that I think I could make a table out of it. Just tell me this. Did you give any instructions? How does he do it? Thought Vimes. How? Out loud, he said, I don't know what you are talking about, sir, but if what I suspect to be true is so, then the answer is no. If there was any foul play that night, it wasn't by my order. I wanted to see Stratford on the gallows. That's legal. And, he thought, I am never going to broach the subject with Willikins. Vetinari's eyebrows rose as Vimes went on, but his lordship's wretched son is being allowed to go on a long holiday full of sun, sea, surf and sand, and economically priced wines. He slammed his fist on the desk, and Vetinari looked pointedly at it until Vimes took it away. Are you going to leave it at that? It has been known, as people put it, for the leopard to change its shorts. All of us hope for a little redemption, whether we deserve it or not. We will keep an eye on the young fool, you can be certain of that. Oh, you're sending the dark clerks after him? Vimes, the dark clerks are a myth, as everybody knows. To tell you the truth, some flunky from our embassy down there will pay attention to his progress. And now the world is a better place, Commander. You have no understanding, Vimes, no understanding at all of the deals, stratagems, and unseen expedients by which some of us make shift to see that it remains that way. Do not seek perfection. None exists. All we can do is strive. Understand this, Commander, because from where I sit, you have no alternative. And remember, for this week's work, you will be remembered. Lord Rust may not like it, but news travels fast. The truth will be known and written down in the history books. Vetinari gave a wan smile. It will. I shall see to it. And slightly better than before, the world will continue to turn. Vetinari picked up yet another piece of paper, appearing to glance at it, and said, You may go, Commander, in the knowledge that I, for so many reasons, envy you. My regards to your good lady. Vimes looked at Drumknot, the man's face so assiduously betrayed nothing that it betrayed everything. Vetinari pulled a file towards him and picked up his pen. Don't let me detain you, Commander. An hour later, Lord Vetinari was sitting at his desk with his fingers steepled, apparently lost in thought, staring at the ceiling, and, to Drumknot's surprise, occasionally waving his hand as if conducting some hidden music. Drumknot knew enough not to disturb him, but at last he dared to say, It was a most memorable recital, wasn't it, sir? Vetinari ceased being the invisible conductor and said, brightly, Yes, it was, wasn't it? They say that the eyes of some paintings can follow you around the room, a fact that I doubt, but I am wondering whether some music can follow you forever. He appeared to pull himself together and continued. On the whole, the Rust dynasty, although not exactly empowered with brains, tends to be an honourable and patriotic bunch, by and large. Am I not right, Drumknot? Drumknot meticulously and unnecessarily tidied some paperwork and said, It is indeed so. Young Gravid is a regrettable exception. Do you think him beyond redemption? Said Vetinari. Quite likely not, said Drumknot, carefully folding a pen wiper. However, Arachne is working in 4X at the moment as a filing clerk in our embassy. She pleaded for the position because she's particularly attracted by venomous spiders. Well, I suppose every girl should have a hobby, said Vetinari. And are there a lot of them in 4X? The place is positively overwhelmed, I am given to understand, sir, and apparently Arachne already has a large selection of them. Vetinari said nothing, but remained sitting with eyes closed. Drumknot cleared his throat. They do say, sir, that in the end all sins are forgiven. Reluctantly, Havelock, Lord Vetinari, tore his recollection away from the wondrous music that he longed to hear again. Not all, Drumknot. Not all. In bed that night in Schoon Avenue, listening to the absence of owls and nightjars, Vimes said, You know, dear, I'll have to go back to the Shires soon. Feeny is a good lad, but they need a proper headquarters and the right kind of guidance, and that doesn't mean just Nobby Nobbs and Fred Colon. Sybil turned over. Oh, I don't know, Sam. Fred and Nobby aren't as bad as all that, and might be all that's needed right now. I mean, they're coppers, but they amble about extremely slowly, and on the whole it's good to see them around. Right now you've got two young men full of vim and vigour, and if you don't want to upset things, it might just be that in that bewildered place they should be backed up by slow and steady, don't you think? You are, as always, right, my dear. Besides, I've seen Fred, and having to rethink his world view has clearly shaken him a little. He'll get over it, said Vimes. Once you get past the stupid Fred, there is, against all expectations, a decent man there. Sybil sighed. Yes, Sam, but that decent man needs a holiday out in the sunshine, away from the smoke and the grime and the terrible spells. But they're the best bits, said Vimes, laughing. No, he needs a holiday. Everybody needs a holiday, Sam, even you. I've just had one, dear, thank you. No, you had a few days interspersed with fighting and floods and murders, and I don't know what else. Look at your desk, make certain everybody is on their toes, and then we'll go down there for another week. Do you hear me, Sam Vimes? Epilogue. And 3 months later, Sam Vimes went on holiday again. And this time he was allowed to steer the black-eyed Susan all the way to Quirm, hardly hitting anything important, and was so happy that they had to find another cat full of sixpences for him to be as happy as. He was amazed at how much fun a holiday could be, but not so amazed as he was 8 months after that, when he and Sybil were invited to be guests at the wedding of Ms. Emily Gordon to the eldest son of Sir Arbuthnot Makewall, owner of the famous Makewall pottery manufactory, and incidentally, the inventor of Makewall's Crispy Nuts, the breakfast cereal of champions, without whose nourishing roughage the bowels of Ankh Morpork would be more congested than was good for them. The Vimes' wedding present was a silver egg coddler, Sybil being of the view that you can't go wrong with a coddled egg. And Vimes was gratified when he noticed at the ceremony that one of the Gordon daughters was wearing a spanking new nurse's uniform, and three others were sporting some quite fabulous and also, to Sybil's great glee, quite scandalous bonnets from the new Gordon Bonnets range. There was an apology from the axe-wielding Hermione, who, according to her mother, was detained in the woods dealing with a very large and troublesome penis, which caused Vimes's face to go blank until Sybil nudged him and pointed out that Penis strobus was the official name for the white pine. But most of all, later that year, Vimes was totally amazed to find that the best-selling novel taking the Ankh Morpork literary world by storm was dedicated to Commander Samuel Vimes. The title of the book was Pride and Extreme Prejudice.